The next case this morning is 5220743, People versus Honorable. Arguing for the appellant is Deepa Punjabi. Arguing for the appellee is John Barrett. Each side will have 10 minutes for their argument. The appellant will also have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please note, only the clerk of the court is permitted to record these proceedings today.
Morning, counselors.
Morning.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Mr. Barrett, we see you again.
Good to see you again.
We've read your briefs, and so we're familiar with the facts on the briefs. Ms. Punjabi, are you ready to proceed?
I am. Thank you, Your Honor.
Let me do so. Thank you.
May it please the court. My name is Deepa Punjabi. I represent the defendant appellant Leandra Honorable. Mr. Honorable was convicted of aggravated discharge of a firearm and unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon. With respect to his aggravated discharge conviction, he argues that the evidence was insufficient, and with respect to his unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon conviction, he argues that the statute is facially unconstitutional under the Second Amendment, pursuant to the test enunciated by the United States Supreme Court in New York Rifle and Pistol Association v. Bruin. And my intention today was to focus my time on the second argument, the facial challenge. However, if this court wishes, I'm happy to discuss the challenge to the sufficiency of the evidence of aggravated discharge and to answer any questions about that argument. Now, as this court is aware, in Bruin, the United States Supreme Court eliminated means and scrutiny for evaluating gun regulations under the Second Amendment and announced a new analytical framework to assess if a firearm regulation can survive constitutional challenge under the Second Amendment. And under Bruin's two-step analysis, we first ask whether the Second Amendment's plain text covers an individual's conduct, in which case the Constitution presumptively protects that conduct. And step number two is that the government must then prove that the regulation is part of our historical tradition of firearm regulations for the law to be upheld. Now, under Illinois' unlawful possession by a felon statute, a person convicted of a felony is barred from possessing any firearm for any purpose for all time. Because firearm possession is conduct that is protected by the Second Amendment, and because the state cannot show a historical analog for such a complete and permanent ban on firearm possession, the unlawful possession of a weapon by a felon statute violates the Second Amendment under the Bruin test. Now, some courts have relied on language in Heller and Bruin about how the Second Amendment applies to law-abiding citizens. And they've taken that language as evidence that the Supreme Court was trying to say that non-law-abiding people are to be categorically excluded from the Second Amendment's protections and that Bruin doesn't even apply to those people. The problem is, this is not what Heller or Bruin hold. They don't hold that the Second Amendment per se excludes non-law-abiding citizens. And in fact, In Heller, the U.S. Supreme Court is quite explicit in saying that the right of the people to keep and bear arms is an individual right belonging to all Americans, to everybody in the national community, not some subset. And to the extent that the Supreme Court repeatedly said the Second Amendment applies to ordinary law-abiding people in Heller and Bruin, the court was simply describing the specific parties in those cases and the specific questions before them in those particular cases. And the same is true when the Heller and Bruin court said, nothing in our opinion today should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions on the possession of firearms by felons or the mentally ill. They were just saying, that is not the question before us today. The question before us today is what restrictions on law-abiding people can the Second Amendment support, because that is who the parties were in those particular cases. And Justice Alito himself says in Bruin, you know, our holding today decides nothing about who may lawfully possess a firearm. But I want to point this, I think this language in Heller was instructive, but I could point this court to the language where the Heller court did say, we're going to have to go through the historical justifications for restrictions on non-law-abiding people once that question comes before us. To quote Heller said, There will be time enough to expound upon the historical justifications for the exceptions we've mentioned to the right to bear arms. And they were talking about felons or the mentally ill. There will be time enough to expound on those historical justifications if and when those exceptions come before us. So when you read all of that language together, it's clear the Supreme Court is not saying that felons are per se excluded from the Second Amendment, and you don't even have to do the historical analysis. To the contrary, what they were saying is we will have to go through the historical justifications for restrictions on Second Amendment rights for felons when that question comes before us. But they're not saying felons are per se excluded from the Second Amendment. In interpreting the people as it's used in the Second Amendment to simply exclude the non-law abiding is problematic, not just because that's not what Bruin or Heller say, but also because it would be inconsistent with how the United States Supreme Court has interpreted the people as it's used in other places in the Constitution. For example, individuals with felony convictions continue to have Fourth Amendment and First Amendment rights because they continue to be a part of the people as it's used in those amendments. So for example, a police officer can't enter a person's home without a warrant just because they were previously convicted of a felony. Or a person's right to protest can't be curbed because they have a past felony conviction on their record.
I don't mean to stop you, counsel, but the right not to have a police officer enter your home without a warrant is different than a convicted felon having a weapon that could be used to kill somebody, correct?
I mean, they're factually different, but I think we have to assume that the people was used the same way in various parts of the Constitution. I take your point that they are factually different scenarios. I also think that Heller language that I pointed out about how we're going to have to go through the historical justifications when they come before us really is evidence that they want us to put us through our paces and go through those historical justifications. And they refer to restrictions on felons as only presumptively lawful because they want us to go through the historical analysis and go through that two-step test.
And if, and I don't mean to stop you, but
sure.
And if I'm looking here correctly in my notes, I think the state concedes that the Illinois courts have not done this, you know, analysis, the post-Bruin that you're requesting, correct?
They did say that. I think that might not be quite correct. I think one court may have gone through it in Brooks in the first district. And I apologize, I didn't cite that case.
Well, and obviously this is not a novel topic. I mean, this is, you know, I'm not going to say it's the taste du jour, but, you know, there's a lot of litigation on this issue.
Yes.
But which goes to my second point is, although maybe there hasn't been much in Illinois yet, there has been, since Bruin, a lot of federal litigation, correct?
There has been. That's correct.
Okay.
Yes. And the cases have come out on both sides of this issue.
Kind of depending on which jurisdiction you're in, correct?
I suppose that's correct. Yes.
It seems to me though, Ms. Punjabi, some of the litigation about felons and possession of weapons focuses on whether it was a forcible felony or a status crime like disposing of collateral, borrowing money from a bank and disposing of collateral. That's not a crime of violence or something that maybe should implicate your Second Amendment rights. But domestic battery, when I was a trial judge, when somebody pled guilty to domestic battery, the statute requires you to notify them with your plea. You may be subject to the Federal Gun Control Act of 1968, and you may have certain rights limited. Here, your client was convicted of aggravated domestic battery, if I recall correctly, which is classified as a forcible felony. So
that's correct, Your Honor. So I would address that point by just pointing out this is a facial challenge, and to the extent that Mr. Honorable here was behaving in a dangerous or unlawful way, that's why he's was convicted of aggravated discharge. And to the extent that he's behaved dangerously in the past, he's been convicted for that conduct. But the question for this court is, can his Second Amendment right to merely possess a weapon for self-defense be permanently taken away for the remainder of his life because of felony conviction of a felony conviction in his background. And I'm not saying that there isn't conceivably a way to conceivably a constitutionally valid way to reduce or restrict a felon's right to possess a firearm. For example, a previous version of the unlawful possession by a felon statute only disarmed a felon for 5 years. And perhaps something like that might be valid under the Second Amendment, but this permanent lifetime ban is completely unique in our tradition of firearm regulations. It's not historically justified under Bruin. And because the permanence of the felon disarmament under the statute applies to every person with a felony, there's no constitutional way to apply it, and it's facially invalid. You know, Bruin instructs us on what counts as a relevantly similar historical analog. The modern regulation and its historical analog must have some similar comparable burdens on the right to bear arms, as well as similar comparable justification or purpose. I see I'm out of time. If I could just finish this one point.
I'm going to go ahead and complete that thought. That's fine.
Thank you. Bruin called this the how and the why. And here, arguably, the state may have presented some status-based historical restrictions with a comparable purpose, but they have not presented anything with this comparable burden of a permanent lifetime ban. And that is the constitutional infirmity, and it applies in every application of this statute. And for that reason, the statute is facially invalid.
Thank you. Other questions, Justice Bowie?
I do, if you will indulge me, Presiding Justice Vaughn. Obviously, the state brings up in their answer brief regarding this forfeiture issue. I pulled up your reply brief, and you address it a little bit. But then in the meantime, if I'm correct, the state filed, again, look here, a motion to cite additional authority, the Ivy case out of the 4th District and the Smith case out of the 2nd. And if I'm reading this correctly, I believe counsel contacted you and that you were going to respond. I don't know if you all plan to respond to that today or are, if you are requesting additional time to submit any written response to, you know, the motion to cite additional authority that deals with these recent cases.
I'm happy to do that if it would be help to this court. I did look at the, once I looked at the authorities, I realized that these were just as applied challenges. And so I thought my reply brief covered those arguments. The state really cites no authority for its position that a facial constitutional challenge can be forfeited. And of course, it's well established that a conviction based on a facially constitutional statute is void ab initio and can be challenged at any time. And this question is purely a question of law. There's no evidentiary record that needs to be developed below. So the state simply needs to cite under the test, needs to cite to historical laws and see how they compare to the unlawful possession by a felon statute. And so I thought that my reply brief adequately addressed that point, but I am happy to respond in writing if it would be of help to this court.
I don't know if it's necessarily helpful. I just wanted to make sure that both of you have the proper time. I know we're short on time on these cases. I just want to give both of you enough time to make sure you make your argument on that issue. And if you want to stand by what you have in your reply brief, I have no problem with that. I would defer to Justice Vaughn and obviously Justice McKinney if they've got any questions on that issue.
I do not.
Not.
Okay. So I'm not going to require any additional writing unless you all at the end of this believe you need that.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Justice Bowie, do you know if we've ruled on the motion for leave to file additional authority?
I'll look that up while Mr. Barrett gets started. If that's okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Robbie, we'll give you a chance for rebuttal in a moment. Mr. Barrett, you ready to proceed?
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel, and may it please the Court, John Barrett for the State of Illinois. I'd like to start by just addressing the sufficiency of the evidence argument briefly. There were a couple of comments in there that are worth looking at. This Charleston case cited by defendant, in that case, the victim who was running away from the shooter had her back turned, and there was no other evidence presented of the direction in which the defendant in that case had fired the weapon, and the police officers were not able to collect any evidence that that bore on the direction of that the weapon was fired. In this case, you have Officer Arrett's testimony that he saw the defendant pointing the gun and firing three times at the red Chevy Malibu. The defendant was running. I mean, he wasn't just in a stationary spot. So, you know, defendant in the brief talks about, well, he was at the lowest point in this on-ramp or whatever at the time. But I mean, this is a chaotic situation where you have a moving defendant shooting. So the defendant was seen from 40 feet away by Officer Arrett at the car. And there was also a bullet hole recovered in that red Chevy Malibu. So here you have a rational connection. The jury was able to reason.
Is that enough, or does there have to, the defense points out, I think there was no forensic evidence connecting the bullet hole to any particular gun or even the casings that were found. It's just a bullet hole. But
That's enough. It's not ideal. Would it be great to have all that other forensic evidence? Yes. But could the jury reasonably conclude, based on the bullet hole and Officer Arrett's testimony, that he saw the defendant firing at the red Chevy Malibu? You'd have to defer to the jury on that. They found that was reasonable. So, and then the other point is that there's a citation of People v. Murray for the proposition that there was an evidentiary gap because the officer squad car, there was no recording. They didn't take a second to turn their video footage on, and that evidentiary gap in the case weighs against the state. They're citing to this case People v. Murray. In People v. Murray, that was actually an expert testimony that was insufficient based on street gang evidence and the statute that requires direct comments on the specific crimes that are committed by that street gang, and that was not presented in that case. So that derives from Supreme Court Rule 705. This case did not involve expert testimony. We had a statute. We had Arrett's testimony on every element of the statute. There is no evidentiary gap. Officer Arrett and his partner, Officer Oberheim, both testified that they heard shots. Arrett saw the shots, and then we also had the bullet hole in the red Chevy Malibu. So that was sufficient. And I know I'm limited on time, so I want to turn as quickly as I can over to the second issue, Your Honors, which is the Bruin challenge. So looking to that, defendant is arguing that as a felon, his rights are protected by the Second Amendment, and that he is included in the people when we're looking at that first inquiry that Bruin requires now. I would refer this court to the state courts that have looked at longstanding prohibitions on felons and upheld this particular statute as constitutional. We have a lot of history in our own state upholding felon dispossession statutes. And the fact that this isn't an as-applied challenge, I think a defendant has a harder burden because, A, we have the presumption that the Constitution is upheld by the statute. The statute itself is constitutional. The defendant bears the burden to show otherwise. And with a facial challenge, you have to show that there are no circumstances under which that statute can be constitutionally enforced. And here, there are all kinds of, one could conceive of felony, violent felony offenses for which we would say that it's absolutely constitutional to remove certain violent felons' firearms under those circumstances. So there's a much harder burden here for defendant to prove from a facial challenge standpoint. Let me refer to I was going to address the comments on Heller and McDonald. Both of those decisions, which came out before Bruin and upon which Bruin relies, Bruin had specifically quoted, I think it was Justice Kavanaugh who was quoting from Heller, and that nothing in this decision is meant to challenge the longstanding prohibitions on felon possession bans. And in that case, in Heller and in McDonald, there's always the, we see the Supreme Court weighing in specifically on felons and saying, hey, we are not telling the states that they can't enact statutes that could prevent a felon or a dangerous felon from possessing weapons. And here we, in the state of Illinois, we have passed such legislation. It's the job of the legislatures to pass laws for the safety of the people. And, you know, dispossessing felons is certainly a within the prerogative of the state to do. I'm sorry, it looked like someone was about to ask me a question.
I'm doing a little research while you're talking. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, no. Go. but so even if we did decide that that felons do fall under or pass that first test in Bruin, and we turn to the historical analysis and look at the historical analogs, it's important to note that in Bruin, we don't have to find a historical twin. So in this case, when we're looking at dispossession statutes, we know that nonviolent felons like those who are convicted of forgery were at stake for capital punishment, for a forfeiture of their entire estates. There were very severe penalties for nonviolent crimes back in the colonies. There's a history of that. And we have recent Illinois cases that have recognized that in our state. In the 2nd District, in the 4th District, in the 1st District, the cases that have come out since Bruin have all upheld felon weapon bans. And the 5th District would, Your Honors, would be the first district to decide contrary to that. Another important point is that People v. Aguilar, I think this was a Illinois Supreme Court case that came out in 2013. Our own Illinois Supreme Court has decided that felon dispossession statutes are presumptively lawful. They acknowledge that in the opinion. And, you know, so we have our own state Supreme Court, several state appellate courts now post-Bruin, arguing in favor of, you know, upholding the current statute, which has been challenged previously in other cases. And then defendant had, there was a motion to cite additional authority for this Prince case. And I was looking at that Prince case. It's not a, that case is not an Illinois state case. It's a federal case. And we are not, this, Your Honors, are not bound by that decision. And the statute at issue there is not the same statute that we're looking at here. It's not this Illinois statute that we're looking at here that numerous courts have already ruled on and decided. So you have a body of law that has already already ruled on this statute numerous times and upheld it. So you have the force of law to uphold here in this circumstance is strong. And that Prince case, I'm sorry, it's not on all fours with this case. And it's not even a state case. It's a federal case. So I just wanted to address that briefly. And I appear to only have 20 seconds left. So I will field any questions Your Honors have at this time and yield the rest of my time to counsel.
Justice Buin, are there questions?
Don't have any questions. I did look up, and that motion to cite additional authority was granted on March 11th.
That's correct, Your Honor. Now that I'm thinking of it, yes.
Justice McCain, are there questions?
No questions.
All right, thank you. Ms. Punjabi, you have a chance for rebuttal. Just proceed.
Thank you. So the state's citation to cases that were decided After Heller, but pre-Bruin, I would like to bring this court's attention to the Illinois Supreme Court case of Shirez, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, in 2018, where that was a facial challenge to the possession of a firearm within 1,000 feet of a public park. But they recognized there that even the regulations that Heller said were presumptively lawful still had to be subjected to the two-step test. And the only difference being now that now we do a historical analysis instead of a means-end analysis at step number two. But our Illinois Supreme Court has rejected the argument that the state made there and that the state is making here that Heller's so-called presumptively lawful regulations don't have to go through that two-step test, or that just because they're presumptively lawful that you can assume that felons are excluded from the Second Amendment, that you still have to apply that scrutiny. And, you know, the other reason I don't know that pre-Bruin cases are that should guide this court's analysis is because the historical analysis required by Bruin is different and more specific than the historical analysis that some courts prior to Bruin, but after Heller, were engaging in our state. While some of those previous cases may have looked more generally to see if a certain kind of firearm regulation has any kind of historical tradition, they have not undertaken this specific analogical analysis, particularly as to whether the comparative burden of permanent firearm dispossession has any relevantly similar historical analogs. Excuse me. I think pre-Bruin cases may have looked more at the comparable justifications or purpose, but not whether there were historical analogs with a comparable burden. But Bruin says you have to have both for it to be relevantly similar. And again, the state here just hasn't pointed to any permanent lifetime ban. You know, the state rightly points out that facial challenges to the constitutionality of statutes carry a high burden. Statutes do generally enjoy a strong presumption of constitutional validity, but in the Second Amendment context, there are additional considerations after Bruin. The Bruin court showed a real, I would say, disapproval of the legislative deference that we normally give when doing constitutional analysis. And they said, look, that doesn't apply to the Second Amendment in the Second Amendment context. To quote the Bruin court, they said, while judicial deference to legislative interest balancing is understandable and is elsewhere appropriate, it is not deference that the Constitution demands here under the Second Amendment. And instead, the court wanted us to be guided by the plain text and by history alone. And they really wanted to get us to get away from that judicial deference to legislative interest balancing. And so the Supreme Court has instructed that the legislative difference that we normally give when doing constitutional analysis does not apply with the same force in the Second Amendment context. Opposing counsel here made a point about Prince not being on all fours. That was a facial challenge to a permanent felon dispossession statute, just like this one, where they found that the statute was facially invalid for the reasons that I'm arguing here, that while there might be comparative justifications in the historical, in our historical tradition of firearm regulations, there is no historical analog with a comparative burden, a permanent lifetime ban. And if I could just address that first argument for one moment, unless there were questions I could answer for the court on the facial challenge.
I guess I'm just not quite following your argument. You concede that there are some felons who could be prohibited, but if you make that concession, aren't you giving up the facial challenge? That sounds more like an as-applied challenge. But
no, what I'm saying, I'm sorry if I was unclear. What I'm saying is that I'm not saying that some felons can be prohibited. The permanence of the disarmament is the constitutional infirmity here. And that exists in every single application of this statute, whether you've committed a very, very serious felony or a less serious felony, there is this permanent lifetime ban of felon possession of disarmament is completely foreign to our tradition of our historical traditions of firearm regulations. The state has not pointed to anywhere where it's a permanent lifetime disarmament. And that is what makes it facially invalid. Does that make sense, Your Honor?
I understand what you're arguing. I'm not sure you have case law to back that up.
Well, it's the state's burden here to show examples in our history of permanent lifetime bans, and they haven't done that. And that's why they can't show their burden under the second step of the Bruin test.
But Heller, I'm looking at Heller right now. There was a line in there that says, although we do not undertake an exhaustive historical analysis today of the full scope of the Second Amendment, nothing in our opinion should be taken to cast doubt on longstanding prohibitions of the possession of firearms by felons and the mentally ill, or laws forbidding carrying of firearms in sensitive places such as schools, government buildings, etc. So the Supreme Court and Heller acknowledged that there are situations where historically bans have been allowed, and they didn't differentiate between lifetime or temporary or...
Because that question wasn't before them, Your Honor. So they said, we're not going to touch this right now. They did say there will be time enough to expound on the historical justifications for these later. So I think they did contemplate that you would have to go through the historical justifications later to see if there is a relevantly similar analog. And here, going through that, the state has not presented any permanent lifetime bans. There's nothing like this in our history and tradition of firearm regulation.
I find that hard to accept. Charles Manson was eligible for parole. He kept applying for parole. So what you're saying, if he had been granted parole, he couldn't have been banned from a firearm for life. That's California. But it just seemed like there are some people out there that the Constitution understands and acknowledges could be banned for life from possessing weapons.
Well, I think that it becomes the state's burden to present that example. And they haven't done that here. And again, I'm not saying that you couldn't conceivably craft a statute that has a historical analog, confining it to certain kind levels of dangerousness and or certain kinds of felonies. But this broad ban of lifetime disarmament, it is completely unique to our tradition of historical regulations. And Heller and Bruin did say these are only presumptively lawful, and we are going to have to go through the historical justifications when that question comes before us. And going through that historical analysis here, now that this question is before this court, the state just hasn't presented the relevantly historical analog.
Right. Thank you. Justice Bowie, the questions?
I don't know. I may be going down a rabbit hole, and maybe I shouldn't. But, you know, when we're talking about this, you know, we talk about, and I believe Justice Fong just said this, or maybe it was you, counsel, you know, in the past, you talk about people with mental infirmities, you talk about felons, and, you know, and then, you know, how they should not be able to possess weapons for various reasons. And then talking about how to differentiate and maybe create a law, you know, certain things. And I mean, I did mental health court and a trial court for 19 years. So I've got a wealth of information regarding mental health issues at the trial level. But so kind of a similar hypothetical would be, you know, under our FOID card system, anyone with a mental health issue is, you know, ineligible to get a FOID card, therefore to have a firearm. But if you start then trying to differentiate between maybe someone who has depression versus bipolar versus paranoid schizophrenia, you know, how do you start trying to differentiate what may be, you know, a mental illness, i.e. a lower class felony that, you know, just as Vaughn brought up earlier, that, okay, maybe those people should be allowed to have a firearm versus someone who's been, you know, diagnosed, like I said, with, you know, paranoid schizophrenia, or, I mean, how do you start then going down into those, you know, categories to make it apply to some, but not others?
Well, the way the United States Supreme Court wants us to answer that question is, you know, it's not about who we think should or shouldn't they want us to get away from means end analysis altogether. And I realize that this is a break from how we normally do constitutional analysis, how we normally evaluate statutes. But that's what the Supreme Court has held. And so how they would answer that question is, you see, are mentally ill people a part of the people? Do they have, I would say yes, that they are. Okay, is the conduct covered at step one, a firearm possession by the Second Amendment? Yes, it is. Now you go through the step two, the historical justifications. How then in throughout history, and the Supreme Court had a particular emphasis on founding era and Reconstruction era regulations. You go through those regulations and see how did they answer that question, and does our modern regulation then have a comparative justification or purpose and a comparative burden in terms of the severity of the penalty? And that's how the Supreme Court wants us to now answer the questions on regulations on the right to bear arms.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Justice McKinney, questions?
No further questions.
All right, thank you. It's an interesting question, and we will consider your arguments, and the brief's already filed. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue a decision in due course.